I woke up this morning with my man.
Hi, hey, Bob.
Dead on feet. Oh, I woke up this morning with my man, Lord. Dead on feet. Oh, I woke up this morning with my man.
Welcome. This is In the Streets with Beverly Smith, and I am your host, Beverly Smith. Thank you for tuning in. The song that opened the show is called Woke Up This Morning by the Freedom Singers. And I am so glad you joined me. In the Streets is your hour of social justice on the LMC Radio Network. We are here to unpack the complexities and the injustices of the American criminal justice system. Thank you for joining me. In the Streets is produced by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in beautiful Forestville, California. Visit them on the web at luckymojo.com. That's luckymojo.com. And also visit the lmcradionetwork.com. That's lmcradionetwork.com. The opinions here on In the Street with Beverly Smith may or may not be the opinions shared by our sponsor. One of the brightest, earliest lights in the civil rights movement was Ella Baker. Ella Baker was born in Norfolk, Virginia, on December 13, 1903, and she grew up to be one of the greatest leading figures in civil rights. She grew up in rural North Carolina, where she was very close to her grandmother. Her grandmother had been a slave, and her grandmother told Ella many stories about the slave times. Her grandmother had been beaten for refusing to marry a man that her master had chosen for her. And this is a sort of thing that put the fire for Justice in Ella Baker. She was a bright student, and she eventually graduated from Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. She was the class valedictorian in 1927. She later moved to New York City, where she began to work for consumer protection organizations, where she became very interested in democracy and women's issues, and she began to work with youths. In fact, she helped start the Young Negroes Cooperative League, which allowed its members to pool their funds to get better deals on goods and services. Around 1940, Baker became a field secretary for the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. She eventually became the NAACP's national director of all the branches. She traveled extensively, and she raised funds and recruited new members, and of course did speeches, mentored members, and encouraged and continued to, she was very much into grassroots activism. Her whole thing was, let us decentralize our organizations. Let's get away from a group of elitists running our resistance, and let's put it in the hands of the people, the hands of the masses, the hands of the many. Well, at this time, she joined the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957 at the request of Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was a group that was created by black ministers and community leaders to help to support and promote civil rights issues. And Baker at that time became very interested in the sit-ins that were taking place across the country. And she went to one of these very famous sit-ins and spoke to the youth that were doing the occupation, that were doing the sit-in at these local diners and these local businesses. And she offered support. She offered her resources. She offered the resources of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She offered the resources of the NAACP. And as a result of Ella Baker's influence, the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came about in 1960. Well, Ella Baker was very, very busy with registration of voters in the South. In fact, she is the one of the ones who helped to organize the Freedom Rides, taking Northerners down South to assist with educational programs, informing potential voters of their rights and their responsibilities and local ordinances regarding their voting rights. She also assisted in 1960, with the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Ella Baker left her position at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She continued to work with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and in 1964, she helped them form the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party as an alternative to the state's Democratic Party, which held segregationist views. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party even tried to get their delegates to serve as replacements for the Mississippi delegates at the National Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, later that year. While they were unsuccessful in this effort, their actions brought a lot of attention to their cause. Ella Baker continued to fight for social justice and equality for the rest of her life. She had so many years of experience as a protester and a grassroots organizer. She believed in building community and building resistance and building the movement from the bottom up. She did not believe in elitists or few people, say a cult of personality that led and dictated from the top down. And Ella Baker will always be remembered for her belief in inclusion and the democratic process. In fact, even in her later years, she was active. She was involved in the Third World Women's Coordinating Committee and the Puerto Rican Solidarity Committee. Her life and accomplishments are chronicled in the 1981 documentary Fundi, The Story of Ella Baker. Fundi, F-U-N-D-I, was her nickname, which in Swahili means a person who passes down a craft to the next generation. Ella Baker moved back to New York City in 1964, and she remained active in social justice issues till her death in 1986. We are reminded of her passion and her determination in the words of this next song sung by Sweet Honey in the Rock. It's called Ella's Song. We who believe in freedom shall not rest until it comes. Please listen now to Sweet Honey in the Rock and Ella's Song. Rise in power, Ella Baker. I want to thank you.
We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. You believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men. The sun is as important as the killing of white men. White mother, son, do you believe in freedom and not rest?
Sing it with me if you like it.
We who believe in freedom and not rest. Older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first. They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light, I may carry us through the gale. We who believe in freedom and not rest. Hear me talking to you. We who believe in freedom and not rest. Then struggling myself don't need a whole lot. I've come to realize that teaching others
talking to you.
Yeah.
Had you heard about the Birmingham Children's March of 1963? I hadn't. I had never been taught a thing about that. Well, from the Daily Beast comes this story about how the children of Birmingham marched in May of 1963. Almost 52 years ago, Charles Avery left his high school in Jefferson, Alabama, to lead 800 of his fellow students on a 10-mile walk to Birmingham City. They were stopped by the sheriff's department, arrested, and jailed. I was put in the paddy wagon with Dick Gregory and his rider, said Avery, who was 18 at the time and the president of his senior class. I will never forget that day. In 1963, Birmingham, Alabama was known as one of the most racist cities in the South. Martin Luther King Jr. had described it as a, quote, symbol of hardcore resistance to integration, end quote. Activists had nicknamed it Bombingham because of the frequency of violent attacks against those fighting the system of segregation. It was the Reverend James Bevel, a leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and an advisor to King, who came up with the idea of a protest group made up entirely of children. In May 1963, they launched the Children's Crusade and began a march on Birmingham. By the time Avery made it to the city on May 7, more than 3,000 black children were marching on the city. It was Dr. King's words that inspired 16-year-old Raymond Goolsbee to participate in the march. Reverend King stood right beside me, remembers Goolsbee, 66. He said, I think it's a mighty fine thing for the children. What you're doing, because when you march, you are really standing up, because a man can't ride your back unless it's bent. And boy, I mean, he talked so eloquent and fast. After he finished his motivational speech, I was ready. On May 2nd, 1963, Goolsbee joined thousands of students who left their classrooms and gathered at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. It was there that they spilled out in groups of 50 to march downtown. My group was the first of 50 to march, said Goolsbee. Our job was to decoy the police. We got arrested about a block and a half from 16th Street. The next day, the police, led by infamous Commissioner of Public Safety Bull Connor, brought out fire hoses and attack dogs and turned them on the children. It was a scene that caused headlines across the nation and across the world. Pictures of the bravery and determination of the Birmingham children as they faced the brutal fire hoses and vicious police dogs were splashed on the front pages of newspapers all across America and helped turn the tide of public opinion in support of the civil rights movement's fight for justice, says Miriam Wright Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. Jessie Shepherd, who was then 16, was soaked when she was loaded up into a paddy wagon. I was told not to participate, says Shepherd, now a retired clinical diet technician, but I was tired of the injustice. I couldn't see why there had to be a colored fountain and a white fountain, said Shepherd. Why couldn't I drink out of the fountain the little kids drank out of? As I got older, I understood that's just the way it was, because my skin was black and we're treated differently because of that. So she marched. Soon the city's jails were so overcrowded with children that students were sent to the local fairgrounds. They slept on cots and sang freedom songs while waiting for the movement leaders to raise money for their bail. I didn't anticipate the outcome being so drastic, said Shepherd. Gwen Gamble had just been released from jail and didn't want to go back. Shortly before the crusade, the teenager had been arrested for participating in a lunch counter sit-in and jailed for 5 days. We were put in with people who had actually broken the law. It was scary. They weren't nice, said Gamble, who was 15 at the time. She and her two sisters were trained by the movement to be recruiters for the Children's Crusade. On the first day of the march, they went to several schools and gave students the cue to leave. They then made their way to the 16th Street Baptist Church. We left the church with our picket signs and our walking shoes, said Gamble. Some of us even had on our raincoats because we knew we were going to be hosed down by the water hoses. Under intense public pressure, Birmingham negotiated a truce with Dr. King, and on May 10, 1963, Bull Connor was removed from his position. The Children's Crusade had worked. The Birmingham campaign was a crucial campaign, says Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. He never led a massive campaign of civil disobedience before, and there were not enough adults prepared to be arrested. So the Children's Crusade turned the tide of the movement. Carson also notes that had King failed in Birmingham, his legacy wouldn't be what it is. If he hadn't won, there probably wouldn't have been an I Have a Dream speech or a Man of the Year award or a Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, said Carson. In honor of the anniversary of the march, there will be a reenactment of the Children's Crusade at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. Today, Birmingham has an African-American mayor, a majority black city council, and a black superintendent of schools. Had it not been for these children going out into the streets of Birmingham, making a difference, going to jail, protesting, I really don't believe we would have today, that what we have today would be possible, said Gamble. I definitely say there wouldn't be a Barack Obama.
The children are mighty, fearless. they chant from their graves.
I'm on
my way to. They chant from their graves.
I'm on
my way to. They chant from their graves.
We will free South Africa. We're coming after you, Bob. We're not afraid of you, Bob. We will free South Africa.
The song we just heard is called War Children by the group In Process. It tells the story of children who were part of a protest, an anti-apartheid protest, during the Pieter Botha regime in South Africa. And those children were arrested, and they were never seen again. They were never heard from again. Their families, their parents, their mothers and fathers never saw them again. The Botha regime disappeared those children. And the song War Children speaks of how their spirits call forth for justice from their graves. That's War Children by In Process. Stay tuned for station identification here at the LMC Radio Network. Time now for station identification. In the Streets with Beverly Smith is brought to you by the LMC Radio Network, sponsored by the good people at Lucky Mojo Curio Company. That's LMCRadioNetwork.com and LuckyMojo.com. Join us for our full set of weekly scheduled shows. On Sunday, it's the longest running show of its kind, the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour with Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali and other noted readers and psychics from AIR, that's the Associated Independent Readers and Root Workers. Join them for free readings and magic spells. On Monday, join the bad boys of Palo, Candela Kambisa, and Tata Salembo as they share the mysteries of the African traditional religions. On Tuesdays, the Reverend John Saint Germain is the voice of the Crystal Silence League, providing spiritual guidance on the practical use of crystals, mind power, divination, and telepathy. Followed by Beverly Smith in the Streets, your social justice hour. On Wednesdays, tune in for poetry and the spoken word excellence of Liquid Libations with Andrea Weston. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, comes the Now You Know show. Professor Porterfield shares with us his knowledge of biblical wisdom and down-home conjure. On Saturdays, it's the Unsacred Ground Radio. You are on sacred ground with Kai Armand as he shares with us the visions, messages, and legacies of those who have walked this land before us. These quality broadcasts are brought to you by the LMC Radio Network. Tune in and listen live, or download the episodes for your listening convenience. That's LMCRadioNetwork.com. Malcolm Michaels Jr., later known as Marsha P. Johnson, was born on June 27, 1944, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and grew up in both Elizabeth and Hoboken. Malcolm would transform into Marsha on his daily commute on the train into New York City. Marsha P. Johnson became a Black American trans rights activist. In 1966, Marsha moved to Manhattan permanently. She was well known in New York in the drag and art scenes from 1960s to the 90s. Sometimes she worked as a waitress, but usually she worked the streets. She was known for helping other transvestites and street people. She was regarded as a drag mother, and in particular was a mentor to the young Sylvia Rivera. She panhandled and was often on roller skates. She was deeply religious and had visions. Marsha P. Johnson was one of the city's best-known drag queens of the time. She was known in the early days as Black Marsha, but later dropped the black and became Marsha P. Johnson, the P, as she loved to explain, including on one occasion to a judge, stood for Pay It No Mind. The judge laughed and let her go. In 1974, Marsha P. Johnson was photographed by fame artist Andy Warhol as part of a ladies and gentlemen series of Polaroids featuring drag queens. An interview with Marsha P. Johnson by gay rights activist Alan Young can be found in the book Out of the Closets, Voices of Gay Liberation, originally published in 1972. Marsha Johnson was no stranger to clashes with the police. She and other gay people were frequently harassed by the vice cops. Gay bars and night spots were often raided, and the patrons, especially the black patrons and the brown patrons, were arrested. The names and photographs of those arrested would often be published in the local papers. One day, the patrons decided to fight back. Marsha P. Johnson participated in the Stonewall Riots in 1969, where she was observed dropping a heavy weight onto a police car. She was the co-founder with Sylvia Rivera of STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, and was active in STAR House, which attempted to feed and shelter the homeless and the street transvestites. Johnson was also a performer and a member of Hot Peaches and did a London tour with them. She never got a female passport and had to do male drag to go through immigration. She was also photographed by Andy Warhol. By 1979, she acknowledged several attempts on her life by Johns, 8 nervous breakdowns, and innumerable arrests. After 100 arrests, she stopped counting. On July 6, 1992, Marcia was probably murdered. Her body was found floating on the Hudson River shortly after the 1992 Gay Pride March. Police ruled the death a suicide. Johnson's friends and supporters said she was not suicidal. Friends spoke of how Johnson had earlier been harassed near the spot where her body was found. Attempts to get the police to investigate the cause of death were unsuccessful. However, in November 2012, the New York City Police Department reopened the case. New York City Baroque pop band Anthony Hegarty and the Johnsons is named in tribute to Marcia. Their 1998 album features a song called River of Sorrows, which is inspired by her death. A documentary called Pay It No Mind, The Life and Times of Marcia P. Johnson, directed by Michael Cassino and Richard Morrison, was released in 2012. I would like to say to Marcia P. Johnson, to her memory, she is one of the heroes of Stonewall, the heroes of the riots. She's a warrior in the streets, and I would like to thank her. Thank you, Marcia P. Johnson. Mendoza was born on July 2, 1951, an orphan New Yorker of Puerto Rican and Venezuelan descent who had lived on and off the streets from the age of 11. She became Sylvia and was mentored in her early days by Marcia P. Johnson. Both were prominent participants in the Stonewall Riots, 1969, the iconic origin of gay liberation. Sylvia was only 17 at the time. She was a founding member of both the New York Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activists Alliance, and helped found STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, with Marcia P. Johnson for homeless transvestites. She organized with Lee Brewster at the 1973 Stonewall Rally. A feminist leader objected to the trans and drag persons as mocking women. Sylvia and Lee jumped on stage and shouted, "You go to bars because of what drag queens did for you. And these bitches tell us to quit being ourselves?" Sylvia fought long against what she considered the assimilationist gay leaders and the New York Human Rights Campaign, HRC, which would ignore trans issues. She fought for homeless and addicted gay people. Sylvia Rivera was also involved with Puerto Rican and black youth activism with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers. She was also an active member of the Metropolitan Community Church of New York and was married to fellow trans woman Julia Murray. From 1997, Rivera lived at Trancy House, the home of Rusty Mae Moore and Chelsea Godwin. Rivera was an alcoholic at this time, but with the Godwins' help and support, she was able to go cold turkey. She renewed her political activism, giving speeches concerning the need for unity among trans persons and their position at the forefront of the LGBT movement. In 2000, she went to Italy for the Millennium March and was acclaimed as the mother of all gay people. In 2001, she revived STAR, and they fought for the New York City Transgender Rights Bill and for Trans-Inclusive New York State Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act. They also agitated for justice for Amanda Milan, a trans woman who had been murdered in 2000. Sylvia Rivera fought with the Human Rights Campaign and the Empire State Pride Agenda, who were neglecting trans issues, in her opinion. Rivera was still negotiating with the Empire State Pride Agenda on her deathbed. Sylvia Rivera died with wife Julia at her side of complications from cancer of the liver at age 50 on February 19, 2002. In her honor, the Metropolitan Community Church of New York's gay youth shelter is called Sylvia's Place. In 2005, the corner of Christopher and Hudson Streets was renamed Rivera Way. And the Sylvia Rivera Law Project is dedicated to guarantee that all people are free to determine gender identity and expression regardless of income or race and without facing harassment, discrimination, or violence. Sylvia Rivera, I want to thank you.
Any way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it on.
That's right. That's the
true
way.
Don't
you stop.
Any way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it.
Any old way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it on.
Any old way.
Any old way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it on.
Any old way.
Any old way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it on.
Any
old way you can make it, baby, you keep on moving it on.
If you can't fly,
run. If you can't run,
come on and walk.
If you can't walk,
country fits for me.
Fits for me.
Well, I move to right the wrong.
Right
there ain't much can be changed by sitting down here singing my song. But I sing to find a spirit.
Keep it up,
keep it up, keep it up.
If you can't
fly,
run.
Come on,
walk. If you can't walk,
That song is a real inspiration to me these days. Let me tell you, that was In Process with their song, Moving It On. And you are listening to the LMC Radio Network. Equal parts educator, politician, and social visionary, Mary McLeod Bethune was one of the most prominent African-American women of the first half of the 20th century, and one of the most powerful. Known as the First Lady of the Struggle, she devoted her career to improving the lives of blacks through education and political and economic empowerment, first through the school she founded, the Bethune Cookman College, and later as the president of the National Council of Negro Women, and then as a top black administrator in the Roosevelt White House. Born on July 10, 1875, in Maysville, South Carolina, the 15th of 17 children to parents who were former slaves, Mary Jane McLeod often accompanied her mother, who did laundry for a living, and it was at one of her mother's clients' homes that she discovered books and became determined to learn how to read. Young Mary attended segregated schools, and she initially intended to become a missionary, but turned to education when the Presbyterian Mission Board rejected her application to go to Africa. After marrying Albertus Bethune in 1898, she moved to Florida, where in 1904 she founded the Daytona Educational and Industrial School for Negro Girls in Daytona Beach, Florida. On October 3, 1904, the Daytona Educational and Industrial Training School opened with just 5 students. Eventually, the school grew to include a farm, high school, and nursing school. The school became the coeducational Bethune Cookman College in 1929 after merging with Cookman Institute, and was fully accredited in 1943. Mrs. Bethune proved her expertise not only as an educator, but also as an organizer and fundraiser through her work with the Bethune Cookman College. She founded the National Council of Negro Women in 1935. She envisioned the National Council of Negro Women to be an organization of organizations that would represent the national and international concerns of black women. It helped black women realize their goals for social justice and human rights through united, constructive action. Mrs. Bethune was a political activist. She was the first African-American woman to be involved in the White House, assisting 4 different presidents. She had the most significant influence on Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. From 1936 to 1945, she served as the informal race leader at large for the administration. She was also one of the most influential leaders in the Black Cabinet, an informal group of federally appointed Black officials who met regularly to plan strategy and set priorities for social change. She also served as director of Negro Affairs for the National Youth Administration, where she worked tirelessly to help young people find jobs and secure funds for youth. Using her clout as a top-ranking Black administrator in the Roosevelt administration, Bethune lobbied for African Americans' concerns and was instrumental in seeing that Black people received help from the federal government. Often, her efforts were unsuccessful. Her attempt to ensure equal pay for Black federal workers was only partially successful, for example, but she persisted. In 1974, Mrs. Bethune became the first Black leader and first woman to have a monument, the Bethune Memorial Statue, erected on public parkland in Washington, D.C., in honor of her remarkable contributions. She also became the only Black woman to be honored with a memorial site in the nation's capital in 1994, when the National Park Service acquired the Council House, Bethune's last official residence and the original headquarters of the National Council of Negro Women. Today, the Council House offers a variety of educational programs and exhibits. Mary McLeod Bethune left the federal government after the National Youth was disbanded in 1944. She continued as president of the National Council of Negro Women until 1949, and in that capacity attended the founding conference of the United Nations. After her retirement, she returned to Florida, where she continued to speak out and write about civil rights issues. She died May 18, 1955, in Daytona, Florida. Mary McLeod Bethune, I want to thank you.
Oh, Mary McLeod Bethune,
woman, oh, can I have a word with you? Yeah. When times were hard and you fell my low, how did you make it through?
Never give it up.
Never give it up.
was in process with I Want to Thank You, and oh yes, I want to say I want to thank you to Claudette Colvin, to Ida B. Wells, to Bayard Rustin, to all the children of the Birmingham Children's Crusade. I want to thank everyone who was involved in the Stonewall riots. I want to thank Mary McLeod Bethune, and I want to thank Ella Baker. And lastly, but certainly not least, I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in for this special New Year's episode of In the Streets. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Beverly Smith, In the Streets, and I want to say goodnight, and on the way out, I'd like to play another song by In Process. It's called Love Is All Around Me, and that's my hope for you in the new year. Good night.
Love is all around me. Love is all around me. And I know it won't be easy. And I know it won't be easy. I know it won't be easy. With love all around me, there's no doubt in my mind, I'm gonna make it. Love is all around me. Love is all around me.
There's no doubt in my mind.